So Rich introduced the subject of discursive emotions, difficult emotions. I think it was called fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. That's correct? Okay. We gave an introduction on this, and Dennis talked a little bit about pain. I believe that was his subject a couple of weeks ago. And tonight I am going to talk about anxiety and fear. And it must be a popular topic. A lot of you are here. And also, I prefer having conversations rather than I'm going to give a talk. So if you have something to add, that wasn't your experience, that was your experience, there's something that you think the Sangha would benefit from, just raise your hand. Please offer whatever you've got to say. Except Brian. He can't offer anything. Okay, so I'm going to start with this statement that the Buddha made. And he said, "Monks, there are beings who suffer not from disease of body for 1 year, for 2 years, even for 100 years. But it is hard to find in the world beings who can admit freedom from mental disease even for one moment. Only those who have destroyed delusions are free from mental disease." So anybody have any idea what he meant by that? What's delusion? Seeing things clearly,
wanting things to be different than they are.
That's another one, right?
How we think most of the time.
Yes.
Feeling yourself as separate, not.
Yes.
Not one with everything.
Mm-hmm. Right. Anybody else have any idea what he meant by delusions? Well, you're all saying different aspects of fear. And I think one way of defining this is being free from fear. Mm-hmm. He didn't define exactly what he meant by delusions, but I think that might be part of it. So fear is one of a multitude of emotions, and psychologists, and I am not a therapist, if there's therapists here and you disagree, you know, feel free to say so. But from my understanding, there's four basic human emotions, at least contemporary psychologists say that, and that's anger, sadness, happiness, and fear. And the others come from those. They are part of those. Those are the core emotions. So fear and anxiety. What's the difference between fear and anxiety? Anybody have an idea?
There's kind of greater intensity.
Mm-hmm. That could be one way of looking at it, sure.
You have anxiety and then you can see through the ratcheting up into fear.
Fear has a specific object that you're afraid of, and anxiety is kind of generalized.
You cheated. That's exactly it. Well, Rich has it exactly. That's exactly it. There's a tangible object. There's a tangible situation that's going on. And anxiety is this miasma of doubt, of whatever, that really has no tangibility to it. But it's right there. And you suffer equally from both, you know, from real fear to anxiety. So is fear always bad?
No.
Is fear a bad thing? Why isn't it? Why isn't it always bad?
Protective.
Safety, right?
Survival.
That's right. That's right. Fear is not always bad. In fact, there are two kinds of what are called healthy fear. And the first is exactly what you just said and what Rich said, real safety issues. Being concerned for one's own safety and the safety of others. You know, taking a child who's running out in the street and having fear they're going to get hit by a car and you immediately do something. Not walking on railroad tracks when a train is about to come down to show off. You don't do those kind of things. You look out for your safety. In Buddhism, though, there's another kind of fear, and it's called altruistic fear. Altruistic fear. And I was talking to Ayasenta Chita, who, when she's here for the climate change meeting, stays with me, which has just been a joy because, you know, we'll talk for hours about Dharma and issues and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I was telling her I was going to talk about this, and she went, oh, Irie and Atopa. Okay, what's that? And she said, moral dread and fear, and it's fear of doing harm. And she said, at Amaravati Monastery, where she trained in England for many years, at the entrance, they have these two very scary beings at the entrance, and they are Hiri and Atopa. And she said, when children come to visit, that's their favorite place to go. It's the scary things that they have to walk past to get inside. So the Buddha said that these were guardians of the world, Hiri and Atopa, because if you don't have this, you don't have a conscience. So altruistic fear is really, really important. It's why we have the five training precepts, you know, which are the basic, the very basic aspects of our practice. Anybody want to recite them? Okay, I will. The very first one is the training in not killing or harming living beings. The second is not taking the training in not taking what is not freely given. The third is the training in avoiding sexual misconduct. The fourth is the training in avoiding lying. And the fifth is the training in avoiding intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. So these are the very basic training mechanisms. And moral dread will appear, hopefully, if you have a conscience, if you just start breaking these randomly and doing what you want, causing harm for yourself and others. There's, a very dramatic story of this kind of moral dread or altruistic fear. And I've told it before, and some of you come all the time, have heard it, so bear with me. But it's about the Tibetan Buddhist monk who had been in a Chinese prison for, I believe, about 20 years, and the Dalai Lama had known him. They had been friends, had been monks together in Tibet. And he was finally released. After 20 years of being in a Chinese prison and being tortured on a regular basis, and the Dalai Lama said he wanted this monk brought to him immediately. He was so happy that his friend was alive. And when the monk came to him, he said to him, how are you? You know, how did you manage? And the monk said, the only thing I feared was of getting angry. Wow. It's altruistic fear, I'm telling you. That's the only thing he was concerned about, that he would get angry. So that's somebody that's an awakened being, you know, completely free of anger and worried about it coming back. So, what's unhealthy fear? We just talked about what healthy fear is, real danger and altruistic fear. What's unhealthy fear?
Everything else.
Everything else. Well, I think it's like what Richard said. This, you know, I'm not quite sure what I'm afraid of, but there's fear going on here. And the really strange thing for a lot of this is we don't even know it's fear. And I'm going to get into that in a moment. But unhealthy fear is the root of all conflict. It's the root for the reasons we can't establish relationships. We might have all kinds of reasons why we're angry or we can't have a relationship or this or that, but underlying it is fear, which I'll go into more detail. And to make this even more complicated, this is one of the murkiest areas of our lives, because it's so unseen. We see the results. You know, I'm unhappy. Why is this happening to me? But we have no idea that lying beneath this is this layer of fear. And I'm going to use fear and anxiety interchangeably because they kind of cross over at times. And I don't like giving long talks, and so I'm not going to be clarifying it all the time. But you can see what the difference is between fear and anxiety, like Rich had defined. And whenever we give in to fear or anxiety, guess what happens? It becomes more solid. it starts to define us. It becomes who we are. And it limits us to what we'll do, to who we'll associate with, because of fear. I had an example of this many years ago. I'd saved money for years to go to Egypt. I'd always loved Egypt. Went to Egypt. This is 1995. And finally get there, and it's wonderful, and ride camels, and go to the Cairo Museum, and everything. And then it was time to go into the Great Pyramid of Giza, and I couldn't do it. I was claustrophobic. I didn't even realize I was claustrophobic. But seeing all these people going down there, these streams of people in this small space, couldn't do it.
Wow.
And you don't even realize it. All of a sudden it comes up and there it was, and I was paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
I missed out after all that time. That's just one small example, and fortunately I saw it, but how many of us have this and we don't even see it? We just avoid, certain situations. I'm going to mention this because I mention it every time I talk about kind of therapy and that kind of thing. Traumatic fear is something else. The trauma, the deep trauma that people have had very often need skilled therapy. So that's my caveat for that. But almost every negative emotion, and especially fear, emanates from three basic fears. They're the fear of losing safety and control. Does that sound familiar? And it's almost like a hierarchy. This one's the most obvious. The fear of losing safety and control. The fear of aloneness and disconnection. The second. And the last one, the feeling of unworthiness. These are the three basic fears that we all have. Now, as most of you know, these are hardwired also in the brain. We would not have survived as a species if we did not have fear, as somebody pointed out. We have to have fear. If we had slithered up on land as we were developing legs and sat on a rock and sunned ourselves and said, "Oh, I'm in bliss, I love this, I love the sun," we wouldn't have survived. We would have been eaten long ago. But we had fear in place, and we knew that we had to be concerned and scared and look around and make sure that we ducked away when danger came. And that then evolved into these other more subtle kinds of fears. There's a very interesting study as I was looking at research in this topic. There's a woman that's very famous among therapists and psychiatrists and neuroscientists who has lost or was not born with the amygdala in the brain, which is the fear center. Have you heard about her?
Yeah.
Did everybody hear about her?
No.
If you did, I'm not going to go into it. But okay, some of you hadn't. They only use her initials, SM, and she's been studied quite a bit with, I think, horrible experiments that they put her through, but apparently she doesn't mind them at all. Putting her in her room with snakes. And she looks interesting at them, and they stick out their tongue, and she sticks out hers, and, that's fun. And then with rats and with spiders and, all kinds of stuff. And they said they put her in some kind of house of horrors that, people, grown men, would vomit in because it was so terrifying. And she was amused, laughed, and, absolutely no fear. And there was one incident that I read about where she took a walk in a dark park in the middle of the night, and a man came running out of the bushes and held a knife to her throat and said, "Give me your purse, I'll kill you." And she looks at him calmly and says, "The angels are going to get you." He dropped his knife and ran away. And she told the scientist, it was interesting. It was interesting meeting him. So that's what happens when we don't have the amygdala part of the brain, that it's missing. So losing, going back to these three categories of fear, losing safety and control, and this includes a fear of physical pain. Losing safety and control. And in most cases, there is no danger to us. And in most cases, we're reacting to pain, the anxiety of pain, rather than the pain itself. I visited today, I think most of you know Lori Devine. Mm-hmm. She's been a longtime member here, and she had back surgery yesterday. Mm-hmm. And she'd been in a lot of pain for actually quite a few years. And I just wanted to go in and check on her and see how she was doing. And she said, and she's a longtime practitioner, and she said she recognized her anxiety and fear of pain, of waking up and being in all sorts of pain after this operation. And I understand back operations can be quite painful. And so she said she decided she wanted hardly any narcotics. She wanted to see what was taking place. She wanted to deal with it. And when I saw her, she was sitting up and talking to her husband, and I said, "Are you in pain?" And she said, "Very little, very little." And I said, "You're doped up now, huh?" And she said, no, really, I'm not. I've had very few, very little pain medication. She said, "I really just started looking at it and realizing it, the fear was way worse than this, than what's going on." And Dennis talked about that, you know, a couple of weeks ago. Actually look at the pain and realize so much of this is just anxiety and fear. I went to the dentist this morning. Oh, Terrell can appreciate this. I didn't have nearly what she had done. I just have a teeth cleaning every 3 months because my teeth are so close together and I can't clean them as well. And I noticed, because I've been working on this this particular topic, fear. I go to the dentist every 3 months and still there's this anxiety of, I don't want someone probing in my mouth. I don't want that happening. But I really started experimenting with it and getting curious about it and realizing my breath was coming very short gasps. The head was feeling constricted. My throat was dry. It was very interesting. As you start looking at it from a bodily point of view, it starts disappearing. You're really investigating it and it loses its hold on you. And by the time I went in, it was, okay, no big deal. This really never is anything but slightly uncomfortable. That's all. I make a big deal about it. Sometimes for days ahead. I got to tell you about one incident. Buddhist Pathways Prison Project, when we had our retreat this summer, we flew up an inmate, and some of you come to my talks have heard about this, Rondell, who was incarcerated from the time he was 16 for 36 years, and he was just let out last December. And I've known him for 10 years. He's been coming to Buddhist services. He's very devoted to this practice. So we said we wanted to fly him to our retreat where he could talk to us about inmate issues, you know, the things that you can't talk about when you're inside but you can talk about when you're out. So I didn't think much about making his plane reservation and all of that. He'd never been on a plane. He had no idea what to do. Mm-hmm. He got on the plane and he was terrified. Mm-hmm. He told us later at the retreat. He was absolutely terrified. He was sitting in the middle row and he said, "Everybody shuts the windows. You can't see out." And I didn't know what was going on. He said it was the worst terrified experience. He goes, "It was worse than solitary confinement."
Wow.
So he used his practice, though, and when he flew back to L.A., he made sure he had a window seat, and he was the only one who kept the window open. And he emailed me, and he said, "That was so much better. I could see what was going on." And I thought, that's exactly it. That's as good an analogy of working with anxiety and fear as I've heard.
And
yeah.
I think some of the examples you're giving, too, really, for me, show how anxiety and fear come together. Like, we name them as if they're separate, but we have these non-rational non-wholesome patterns of fearing. And there can be an object. We can think, we can believe the fear and think we're afraid of X or Y, but if it's being driven by something that has its own momentum, has its own identity, then that's where the two blend, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's actually starting to see that and actually to see it, like Rondell did. This is what's going on. Can I really see what's happening? That's shining the light of mindfulness on it. So, another one where we don't have control, and believe me, this is big in prison, is anger. For most, anger, fear is behind it. Fear of losing control, fear of not being in charge, and so anger erupts. So real freedom in this regard is realizing so much of life is beyond our control. We're not going to be able to control anything. And we can control a lot, but we can't control everything, because it's the definition of life. Everything happens. You know, and we can either fear it and develop anxiety and phobias about it, or we can look at it squarely, which is what mindfulness asks us to do. So the second one is aloneness and disconnection. It's the fear of abandonment, loss, and death. I think a good example of this is women who stay in abusive relationships. I'm sure men do too, but especially women tend to do that. My grandmother was a very difficult person. I happen to like her a lot because I think I take after her. My grandfather had a lot of difficulties with her, and his favorite statement was, better to live with the devil than to live alone. That's fear of abandonment. That's fear of being alone. And then, you know, obviously our fear of death. You know, that's a big one. And the Year to Live group, and many of you have been in my Year to Live group, this is what we tackle. We actually look squarely at, we're all going to die. Every one of us is going to die. And to get comfortable with that, the Buddha had said, this is called mindfulness of death is Marana Sati, mindfulness of death. And the Buddha said there's three mindfulness practices that are suitable for everyone. Anapanasati is mindfulness of breathing, which we do when we're sitting in meditation. Metta, which is a practice of boundless friendliness, loving kindness to all sentient beings, and Maranasati, mindfulness of death. This is our whole life that we're looking at when we look at these three aspects. So a central component, as you can see from this one, of our spiritual practice is being comfortable with the uncomfortable. Actually being comfortable with what's uncomfortable. And sitting there, being with it. And for some, there can be, I know for me, when I've been with people who are very sick, with my own husband as he was dying, my son-in-law and me, and my mother past couple, 4 months ago when they died, there was a real freedom in just letting go. Just being for a bit. Not having to do anything. Nothing to do anymore. And it's really strange unless you've experienced it that just, I can just be with this person. I can't fix anything anymore. There's nothing more to be done. We can be real. So that's the upside. Unworthiness. Okay, this is the third basic fear, and it takes so many forms. You know, this is the most subtle of all. And it's the one so many of us suffer from. I'm stupid, I can't do this, I don't want to go there, no one likes me, it's not the people I hang out with, you know, you name it. It goes on. And it even happens in creativity. I can't do this because I can't draw as good as her. And there's a wonderful TED Talk. I don't know if any of you heard it. It was by a psychologist, and it's on creativity in children. And he was talking about how we limit creativity in children by telling them this is the way you should be doing things. And he said, in this world, we need the most creative people we can get. We're in a lot of bad situations with the climate, with how we treat each other. He goes, we need creative people. So he talked about this one incident where this little four-year-old girl was in her class and they were having drawing time. And the teacher was wandering around looking at all the kids' drawings and making, you know, nice comments. And he came up to her and looked at what she was drawing and he said, so, Annie, what are you drawing? And she said, well, I'm drawing God. Hmm. And he said, well, nobody knows what God looks like. And she said, they will in a minute. I love that story. And I think that's probably true for a lot of us who thought we'd take on some hobby or we'd do something and then we limit ourselves and go, I can't do that. You know, I'm going to fail at that. Why do I even try? Everybody knows I can't do that. So we limit ourselves so much with these really silly anxieties. If we look in on them, we're doing it to ourselves. How much enjoyment are we cutting out because we're not willing to take a chance to be creative? So how do we work with fear? Well, how do we normally work with fear? How do most Americans work with fear, even if they happen to even see it come up? What do people do?
Deny that it's happening.
Shut it down.
Shut it down, what, Rich?
Deny that it's even happening.
That's right. That's right.
Medication.
That's right. Drink.
Watch television.
Watch television. Eat.
Power trip. You know, there's a value on you know, grabbing fear and subduing it somehow. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Buy a gun. I think Americans also will, in certain contexts, will talk to other people about what's going on. I think it's kind of common.
If they can tell, you know, that is what's going on, I think you're right. I think for a lot of us, it's really hard to even recognize that fear is taking place, which is going to be my final question to you, but I sneaked it in right then. So how do we work with fear? And you're right. We look for diversions. You know, we look for any way we're not having to deal with it. We don't want to face it. The Buddha said this whole practice is going against the stream. That's going against the stream by looking at what's taking place rather than drinking or eating or buying a gun or, you know, whatever it is that we want to do just to get away from this uncomfortable feeling. Fear is uncomfortable, both physically and mentally. It's uncomfortable and we don't want it. And the bad news is the more we push it away, the more ingrained it becomes. And the amygdala, which is that fear center, is habit forming, and it will start responding to these fears that you have created for yourself habitually, and then you will limit yourself in your entire life. The good news is there's a way out of it. And you know, I read all kinds of suttas and then psychologists and everything else. It came back down to our basic method, the shortcut for mindfulness, which is RAIN. Does everybody know what RAIN is? Okay. We're going to go, if you don't, it's fine. We're going to go over it anyway, because it works with fear absolutely beautifully. And RAIN, the first one is R stands for recognition. Recognition. So this is exactly what we said. Most Americans, and probably the rest of the world too, any kind of diversion, get away from it. We're saying just the opposite. We recognize it. Fear is happening. Not I am fearful. Fear is taking place right now. Now, you can say that also with a whole lot of victimization, with animosity. I don't want it this way. So there's a fine line. Knowing fear is taking place without going to this negative place, and I don't like it. I don't like it like this at all. Just fear is taking place. This is what's going on right now. The second letter in RAIN, A, is acceptance. Acceptance that fear is going on right now. It's not me. It's going on right now. I probably can't change this because for some reason it's rising. But I can accept that it's taking place. And it's another passing mental state. And the I is investigation. And just like I told you about Lori actually looking at, instead of just going with the anxiety, and I know I'm going to have a lot of pain because it's back surgery, and I'm going to take a lot of drugs, she investigated it first and found out, nope, wasn't so bad. What was so bad was what? The anxiety. This is going to be awful. I've had back surgery. Everybody's told me how awful back surgery is. I'm going to be in so much pain. She didn't buy into it. She looked at it herself and said, yeah, it's uncomfortable, but it's not bad. It's not bad. That's investigating. And then the N is non-identity. This is not you. You are not the pain. You are not the anxiety. Again, it's a passing mental state. They come and go. Happiness comes and go. Sadness comes and go. Fear comes and goes. This is what happens. And as long as we don't grasp onto it and start defining ourselves with that, we'll be okay.
Diane.
Yeah.
When I went on Kabbalah Master's retreat like a month or so ago, mm-hmm. and she substituted the word allowing or mm-hmm. allow for acceptance, in that the energy around that is a little bit more open. Sometimes acceptance feels like you think it's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've found that very useful.
That's
because,
good.
Because it's easy to sit with allowing it to be what it is and to unfold.
Excellent.
So you can really see it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's good. And I like that too. I think I'll change this.
Yeah. I like it a lot, yeah.
And so, okay, how would you respond? You have a child or grandchild or a neighbor, and they're staying at your house, and they come running to you saying they're terrified of the dark. How would you respond? What would you do?
Get a nightlight for them.
That's not the answer I wanted.
Oh, okay. Very practical.
No.
Give them a hug.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
Give them a hug, tell them it's going to be okay, comfort them, it's all right, there's not monsters in the dark, I'll stay here with you for a while. I mean, yeah,
also
Margaret.
Talk to them about what the specific their fear is.
It's
give them a chance to allow that, I guess.
Very good, very good. And this is what we need to do for ourselves. We need to treat ourselves in exactly the same way. Not judgment or why do I keep doing that? Why am I always afraid when I go here? Why do these people scare me? Treat ourselves kindly with metta. You know, in metta, who's the number one person we start with?
Yeah.
Ourselves. With loving kindness for ourselves. So I was reading this commentary on the Buddha's awakening. It was actually quite good to read about this because I'd always thought, and it could be true, but this commentary takes a different point of view. When the Buddha awakened, he completely ditched Mara. Mara in Buddhism is kind of like the devil. Not really the devil, he's these discursive emotions, you know, that keep coming up and plaguing us and keeping us from being awake. And so when the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree, Mara kept visiting with his 10 daughters, who are the 10 fetters. That's another talk. Go into another time. And so every time the Buddha saw Mara coming up and trying to tempt him, you know, with greed and hatred and jealousy, and you can't do this, he would say, Mara, I see you. Mara, I see you. later, and this is what I found surprising, as the Buddha sits and his life goes on, Mara keeps visiting him. Mara shows up on lots of occasions. And you read the suttas, and it's true. So awakening doesn't mean it's gone forever, at least according to my understanding, which could be completely wrong. It means that you have the wherewithal, the ability to see it for what it is. It's constantly going to be coming at you. It came at the Buddha, all of these discursive emotions, but he saw it. Mara, I see you. And then they have this description of Mara. It's almost sad. Mara hangs his head sadly. I couldn't do anything. And he goes walking away despondently. And it's always these. You almost feel sorry for him that he just doesn't get his way. He becomes very, very human-like. But the Buddha always sees what he's about. And that's what we've got to do as well. Just see exactly what is taking place. Not easy with fear, because it underlies so much. But that's also what this practice is about. Our meditation practice is about waking up to what's taking place. And for many, especially people taking beginning meditation who are just starting in this practice, who will often say, and this is true in our free community as well as prison, I came here because I want peace of mind. I want to be happy. Mm-hmm. I want everything to be okay. Like life is going to change, you know, like life is not going to happen. Like you'll never get sick, you won't die, you're not going to lose things. And when you start in meditation, start seeing these underlying causes for what they are, a lot of people don't want to hear that. They want bliss. And they tend to leave. And the really strange thing is our comfort comes from being with that very insecurity that we're trying so hard to escape from. Being okay with that. Seeing life as it is, it's rising and falling, beginning and ending, and being okay with it. Equanimity, upeka. So anyway, I have one last question for all of you, and then we'll be leaving at 8:45. You're welcome. My last question, and I really want to hear what you have to say. Why is it so difficult to identify the fear that underlies so many other difficult emotions, such as anger? Why is it so difficult? Anybody have any idea?
No. Well, because then we feel like we can't do anything, can't change it. It's like, oh my God, then what? Then it's got me.
Hmm. It feels overwhelming. And I know for me, I think I often will identify, I think I am that person.
Right, right.
You know, it's very in the moment, it's very hard to say, this, I can do it sometimes, but in that real, it's very hard to say, this is anger or this is fear.
Right.
It's much more like, I'm afraid, I gotta get out of here.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah.
Well, I think it is what you said in posing the question, which is, it's often under layers of anger or irritation or,
exactly,
or other kinds of things, and it's only when you stop and realize that underlying that anger is a fear of something happening.
Exactly. Yeah. But for most of us, we can't do that. We don't see it. You know, and yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And why is it so difficult to do that?
Sort of a loss of control.
Loss of control,
it's
that's right.
Also to do with identification with self, so it makes us weak to kind of acknowledge that it's fear underneath this.
I think
anger gives you some sort of control.
Yeah, loss of control, and that was the first big fear. Yes, Brian, are you back there, or are you stretching?
Yes, I'm safe.
Okay.
I think for me, the fear is
I am bringing in fear as a weakness, and you don't feel fear. It's socially acceptable to be angry.
Yeah.
It's socially acceptable to be upset. But if I say I'm fearful, I'm a weak, you know, sissy or whatever, and that's the connotation my mind takes on it. So when I start working with fear, and I tell the wrong person that I'm fearful, you know, get a grip, you idiot, or whatever, you man up, or whatever the terms are. Yeah. So for me, that was a huge to start, you know, identifying fear rather than anger.
Right, right. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I think it has something to do with fear is something about us, and we're reluctant to look at, take responsibility. Anger has to do with an object or a person outside of you.
I think that's kind of what Marini was saying as well. Yeah, that control thing. I can do this only to a point, but there's something else outside that. And that makes it much easier. Yeah, Barbara?
I think somebody said something like this. It's identification. It's failure to sort of grasp one of the three characteristics of Nietzsche, because we identify with the fear, and that's, we don't see that we're not, that it's, fear, it's not us, and so it's very hard to see it.
Yeah, extremely hard. That's why I posed the question. I was, Miles?
I think, especially if you're a man, fear, anger is empowering, and fear is disempowering.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah.
I think the outside world really draws attention, just in general.
Yeah, I agree with you. Thank you.
Well, another thing is we of course in this country we put a high premium on anger. It's good.
You're absolutely right.
Donald Trump and his stuff.
That's right.
His followers is probably a flattering word. But you know, anger is we enshrine anger. Sports and
you're right. I think you're saying what Brian was saying. You know, admitting fear is admitting weakness. That just can't take place. There's an inmate at one of the prisons I go into. I had given a talk on self-identity and how limiting it is. And one of the Latino gang members gave up his gang affiliation, went into ADSEG, went to another yard. And I was talking to one of his friends about 2 weeks later. And I asked where Chris was. Oops, I'm sorry, I don't want to say names. And he said, he gave up his gang affiliation. And I said, well, good for him. And he said, no, that's not good. That's not good at all. They take everything from us. They can't take that. Mm-hmm. And I said, would you get out of prison if you did? And he said, yeah, but they're not taking that away from me. I'll show them. And I said, so you're willing to stay in here to have this name in back of your name and not see your family and just languish in here. You're still a young man. He said, yeah, they're not taking that away from me. And I just realized, wow.
That's anger.
That's right. Holding on, and I'm holding on to that rather than, as he said, they're not going to take away my dignity. So, yeah. It's anger is definitely a huge impetus in this society, never admitting fear. Yeah, Brian?
Yeah, just talking about ways to kind of work with fear. Like over this summer, I was doing some backpacking, and I was going solo. And just being out there, you kind of acknowledge that you're going to be, you're losing control, you're giving up a fair amount of control. And with that comes, a loss of anger. You can't really get angry at the bears or the lightning or, all these sorts of things, right? So it just gets it very simple, and you're happy most of the time, but you can get really afraid, So you see that, how it works without spin or adding on story. Like, you just want to be safe.
Right.
And you're not so sure at certain times. and in getting afraid, you're not getting into X, Y, and Z.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's great. That's mm-hmm. wonderful. Kind of like a walking retreat then,
yeah.
and facing all of this stuff and really having to look at yourself rather than anything on the outside.
And it's very easy because one of the great experiences of being out there is there's no judgment.
Yeah.
You're not being judged from external sources to be anything other than how you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember just, you know, getting back and just being in a car and looking at people and, you know, sensing that the judgments or the positive or negative that you just don't get in the world.
That's great. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
That's so true. Who knows? And then Sarah.
I was just thinking, listening to Ryan talking, is that the when you look at fear, it sometimes feels bottomless almost.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of our life is that nothing is certain. So when I look at fear, I look at the fact that I could die walking across the street. I could, you know, and it's sort of when you open the Pandora's box, then you really need to sit with a whole myriad of things.
That's right.
And that anger cover up it feels like you're safe.
That's right. That's right. That's very astute, and I totally agree with you. Yes, Sarah Bell?
When you asked about why fear is so difficult, in my case, usually fear is associated to my inner child.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes, even though we carry that child all the time with us, we just forget about him.
Mm-hmm.
Or about her so often that we realize it,
mm-hmm.
that it's all coming from
yeah.
that little being.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Although I've got another interesting prison story. It's women prisoners. I gave this talk a very truncated version because I can only talk for 15, 20 minutes in prison. But I brought this up, and I brought up traumatic fear because I figure a lot of these women, they've been victims of sexual abuse and all kinds of stuff. And so my caveat was, you know, traumatic fear, and you have to be concerned about this. And two of the women are rolling their eyes. They're very demonstrative, you know, when you're hitting a home run or when they just have had it with you. And so I said, so what's going on? And both of them said, both of these women have been in prison. They're now about 30, and they've been in prison since they were 16. And they said, especially one of them, I have been to more therapists. I've seen more people take me apart. I am so sick of my own story that I just don't want to deal with it anymore. That's why I come to this class, because you at least talk about what we can do right now rather than going back again and again and again. And I said, you've got trauma from therapists. So, yeah, I think I do. All right. Any final words of wisdom for the Sangha? All right. Then we're going to close it up. You get out at 10 minutes to 9. You're welcome. So have a seat. We're just going to do a final metta. May all of us in this room be safe and protected from all types of harm and danger. And may we recognize fear and anxiety for what it is, passing mental states. Do not define us. Don't let our hearts close because of these fears and anxieties, but let us see them exactly for what they are. And may our lives be of benefit to all sentient beings, and may every one of us in this room become absolutely, completely free in this lifetime. So thank you for all coming.